Hey everyone, welcome to my name is Larissa. I am an addict, and I'm also the GSR for the CA Service Sponsorship Group. So glad you guys are all here. The CA Sponsorship Group, we're an open meeting of Cocaine Anonymous. We meet virtually 6 to 8 times a year for the purpose of recruiting, educating, and activating CA Service Trusted Service to ensure continuous service to those who suffer from addiction. The CA Service Sponsorship Group presents service topics for study, discussion, and practice of service sponsorship in Cocaine Anonymous at the group, district, area, and world level of service. Thank you for joining our speaker workshop presentation, Carry the Message, Not the Wreckage. Today's presentation will be facilitated by Cameron F., a member of Cocaine Anonymous. Cameron's sobriety date is November 21st, 2003. As a speaker and facilitator of 12-step recovery, Cameron has spoken to numerous AA and CA group meetings, district roundups, area conventions, and CA world conventions across Canada, United States, the UK, Europe, Asia, and Africa on topics such as the 12 steps and the 12 traditions and the 12 concepts. In business, Cameron has coached audiences on how to be a better keynote speaker, including overcoming the fears of speaking, structuring your talk, dynamics for excellent presentations, powerful openings and closing, key messaging, etc. It is our hope that this CA Service Sponsorship presentation will prove helpful to those who wish to carry a hopeful message to those who still suffer from addiction in and across to the rooms of 12-step recovery. Take it away, Cameron.
All right. Well, thank you for that kind introduction, and it's great to be here. Saying earlier, I've done a lot of speaking over the last 2 decades, more so now even with Zoom and the ability of the fellowship to connect and have me come out and speak at various groups around the world. It's been quite extraordinary. I think I've done close to 600 keynote shares in the last 4 or 5 years since COVID started. And as much as I enjoy speaking, I don't think there's anyone left in the fellowship that hasn't heard me. So it's about time you guys stepped up, joined the circuit, and get out there and start speaking. And I can retire and listen to you guys for a change. So we're going to delve into it on carrying the message, not the wreckage. And we'll kick things off with, do you know what most people are afraid of out there? What are things that most people are afraid of? Well, I've come to learn that the vast majority of the population is afraid of.
I don't like spiders and snakes, that many, what it takes to love me, like I want to be loved by you.
Raise your hand if you're afraid of spiders and snakes. It seems to be a big fear out there. They say that a third of the world's population has a fear of spiders, which is arachnophobia, and a fear of snakes, which is ophidiophobia. And by the way, my son, who's 42 years old, Victor, he breeds spiders, scorpions, and snakes, as well as breeding all sorts of creepy crawly bugs to feed these critters. But it's a big fear, and how do we overcome our fear of spiders and snakes? We deliver a presentation on spiders and snakes. I throw overcoming the fear of spiders and snakes in as a bonus. Okay, but seriously, let's carry the message, not the wreckage. Each individual in their personal stories describe in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. That's from page 29 of our big book. And this is a big book focused speaker sharing workshop. We can only clear the ground a bit if our testimony helps sweep away prejudice. Now, I believe every addict has a story to share, and somewhere in the fellowship, there is an ear that needs to hear your story. And your recovery story as an ex-problem addict, is important. In fact, it's vital to the fellowship to hear these stories, these narratives that we carry in the rooms. A good share will identify with those who struggle with addiction. They will in turn identify with you. Hey, I'm like you, you're like me, but you don't do it anymore. And dang, I want what you got. How is that possible? And you certainly have my attention. And then by sharing what happened and what we're like today, the newcomer comes to believe that there is hope. There is hope that they too can escape their difficulties and win the newcomer's confidence. Now, one caveat when speaking, and that is, let's carry the message, not the wreckage. We must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. And so often I hear speakers go to the podium and they don't know when to shut up.
You talk too much, you worry me to death. You talk too much, you even worry my pet. You just talk, talk too much.
I really love doing Zoom presentations. There's so much we can do with this platform to make presentations and shares that much more interesting. So you've been asked to speak or to share at a meeting, a convention, now what? And far too often we hear speakers share drunkalogs, war stories, junky pride tales, even ramblings of incoherent thoughts and the minutia of one's daily life I've heard shared at the podium. I always know I'm in for one of those long-winded war stories when the speaker starts with something like, I remember my first drink. I was in my mother's third trimester. And I realized I didn't drink like the other fetuses. And I go, oh my God, here we go, right? It's going to be one of those types of shares, 45 minutes on how to drink, how to use, how to act out. I'm already an expert in that that respect. And some speakers just don't know when to stop. Many times I've heard a speaker share, and just when I think they're wrapping it up and they're concluding what I think would be a good place to conclude, they digress into another stream of consciousness and they go on and on ad nauseum. And so knowing when to wrap it up, because you don't want to leave your audience with the feeling that you talk too much. Now, throughout this presentation, if you've got questions that you want to ask, feel free to raise your virtual hands, and throughout the presentation, we'll try to address them. We're going to try and get this workshop concluded within 2 hours. And so feel free to ask questions as we go along. Now, the learning objectives for this presentation, by the end of this presentation, coupled with that, we'll post the audio and the slideshow on the website for your benefit. You'll understand and be able to list 10 strategies for overcoming the fear of public speaking. You'd be surprised how many people have a fear of being in front of an audience. You'll be able to list 5 ways to conduct yourself when speaking virtually or in person. Identify 3 major benefits of speaking to a 12-step meeting or an event. List 3 key elements for a compelling story. List 3 ways to win the confidence of newcomers. Know 3 essential components for a well-structured story. Learn 3 ways to dynamically open your share. Know 4 ways to identify and connect with your audience. Identify 5 important ways to describe what happened. Describe 3 ways to inspire others to work their program. And lastly, learn 3 approaches to dynamically close your talk. Now, before we launch into it, we do have a 7th tradition. Larissa, I'll go back to you on this one.
Hey, Larissa, still an addict, alcoholic. So if you find this workshop useful and helpful, please consider making a 7th donation via our website, or you see the QR code on the screen. Your donation helps to offset our Zoom and website costs. Our needs are simple: an app to host our meeting and a website to help carry the group's message. Yes, those of you who can give generously for a donation of $20, $10, or $5, or whatever you can afford, will go a long way to ensuring that this workshop continues. You can make a 7th tradition donation via our website, caservicesponsorship.org, 7th tradition, and I will have that posted in the chat. which connects you to our PayPal account, whereby you can donate either through PayPal or credit card. Thank you all so much for your generosity and for being here.
Thanks, Larissa. Yeah, we really do appreciate the generosity and support. Of course, it is entirely voluntary. And I know it takes a little more work when you're on Zoom. It's not like being an in-person meeting where we pass the basket and you can throw in, a couple of bucks or whatever it may be. But your seventh does really help offset our costs. And that leads me to another video, song clip.
Your love gives me such a thrill. But your love won't pay my bills. I want money.
I think secretly I always wanted to be a DJ. Okay. Let's get into it. To some degree, 73% of the public are affected by what's known as glossophobia, which is the fear of public speaking. And the question is how do we get over the fear of public speaking? And this fear is more common than the fear of death and can significantly impact personal or professional life. It's bigger than the fear of death. That means most people would rather be in the box than do the eulogy. Like, that's pretty amazing. So the question is what are we really afraid of when we are asked to share or speak at a meeting? What kind of fears do we come up? And I'd like to get you guys to weigh in on this. I'm just gonna click off the sharing screen here. What is it we're afraid of when we're asked to do a share? What are some of the fears that pop up for us? Raise your virtual hand. Come in, Anishwara.
Hi, Cameron. Thank you so much for your service. I would think that the number one reason is fear of rejection.
Yeah, oh my God, what if they don't like me? I remember I spoke at a meeting. It was called the Golden Mile Club. This was one of my early shares. And they had a big banner stretching across the podium called Meeting Makers Make It. And I'm not a big meeting maker. I'm more about working the steps. And I delivered this share. And in those days, it was AA. And I used to cuss a lot. And, one of the things I've learned about sharing in Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't swear because the audience won't hear it. And so I did my share. And at the end of this 40-minute presentation, there is dead silence in the room. And there was about 80, 90 people in this audience. There was dead quiet. And then I heard someone go, "Well, I didn't like that at all." It was pretty brutal. I learned a lot from that very first share. So thanks, Anushwara. Yeah, what if they don't like me? What if I'm rejected? Stacy, come on in.
Hi, Cameron. Yeah, I'm Stacey. I call it addict. Mine would be at the moment fear of my memory because I've got a memory problems. So yeah, but I guess if I write it down, yeah, that's fine, me.
Yeah, like
Thank
what if we
you.
go to the podium and we have a mental blank spot and I can't remember what I was going to share, or maybe I got interrupted and it took me off track and oh my God, now what? And then the panic sets in. That's a very real fear and can be a real problem when we're asked to share at the podium, but we got a way to handle that. I'll come to you shortly. Larissa, go ahead.
Yeah, you got Freddie in the chat. Fear of vulnerability, stuttering, or non-linear talking points, freezing up.
Yeah, very much so. By the way, folks, I used to stutter. In fact, when I was a teenager, I stuttered. I couldn't get words out of my mouth to save my life when I used to have to share in high school. And it was really debilitating. It was a real impediment to any kind of socialization out there. In fact, I really found my stride and I found my enjoyment of speaking was through the 12-step program. So there are ways to overcome. Now, if stuttering's a real like a clinical problem, anyone seen The King's Speech on Netflix? That was a great movie about how he helped King George overcome his fear of speaking because he was a real stutterer and his ability to overcome and make his speeches. So thank you. Yes, real fear. Freddie.
Hi there, Cameron. Thanks, Larissa. Another one that came to mind is I want people to care about what I'm saying. I want them to be engaged, and I don't want to bore them. So I know that's what we're here for, to learn, but that's a fear of what if I get off topic or I'm seeing people yawning or giving the glassy eye look.
Yep. What if you're boring? What if people stand? I remember I spoke at a group, and that was a kind of a controversial speaker, and like a third of the room stood up and walked out. I thought, oh my God, that can be really, nerve-wracking and put a lot of pressure. And the other people in the audience thinking, what do they know that I don't? So absolutely. What if we're boring? What if it's a snooze fest? How do we make our talks more dynamic? Thank you, Sharon. Have to unmute, dear. Can you unmute yourself? That's right. Hit the unmute button. Right, Sharon, we'll come back to you. I think Sharon
I think
froze
she
up.
froze up.
She froze up. Literally, that could be a real problem on a Zoom presentation. What if I freeze up? I was having a fear today. I was thinking, what if the power goes out right in the middle of the presentation? What if there's a power shortage? What if my computer shuts down? Go ahead, Francine.
Hi, Francine, Eric alcoholic. My fear is I forget my sentences before I finish them. I honestly do. I can't keep my I'm sure a lot of this has been shared already, but I can't keep the flow going. Like I'll digress to some story to do something and then I forget where I was going with the whole thing. Don't worry, I got the door. And that's my problem. Thank you for letting me share.
Thanks, Francine. Yeah, I've done that. I'll be sharing, and then a thought will occur, and I'll add that thought, and then I'll digress down a certain branch, and then forget where I'm at in my presentation, and that can really, create some challenges. Sharon, we lost you for a minute. You want to come in? Your unmute is not unmuting.
I sent you an unmute.
There
There
it
you
is.
go.
Sorry, I don't do Zooms very often. I apologize. My biggest fear, I think, is sounding stupid and uninspiring because it would be a big deal for me if I go up there. I want to, maybe it's self-seeking behavior in a way. I don't know if it's a defect, but I really want to make an impact. And if I saw people yawning or feeling like they're judging me, I'm not as smart as the last speaker I heard. That keeps me in fear of kind of spreading the message like I should.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking incompetent, not being worthy of your audience. I remember this is when I was doing secular presentations, and I went in front of a room full of bankers and I froze. All of a sudden, I didn't think I was worthy enough to speak to these people. And the present and I was being paid a good fee for this presentation, and it was disastrous. And the fear rose up, and I fell into the trap that I wasn't worthy enough, and it led to a really, really bad presentation. Tracy, go ahead.
I think I have a fear of not being able to carry the message properly from the big book and give the solution as it is written. Like I'll freeze up and I'll give somebody the wrong clear-cut directions. So thank you.
Right, yeah. Absolutely. What kind of a message do we want to carry? And is it a good message or is it a drunkalogue or just another war story that people have heard ad nauseum? Go ahead, Heidi.
Oh, sorry. Hi. Sorry, I was struggling to unmute then. Yeah, I think mine's similar to what people have already mentioned, but I think for me, it is just like a fear of Sometimes I'll just sit in a meeting and I'll think that I don't have anything worthy to say. You know, it's that feeling of not, I suppose, not feeling good enough, like a confidence thing. And so I'll shy away from sharing back because I don't think I've got anything worthwhile saying, sharing.
Yep, absolutely. So the fear of, being a failure, looking incompetent, making mistakes, forgetting what we're talking about, not being worthy, all of these are fears that pop up. Now, I have a video clip that I'm going to share with you. How many people, now only the older people will know this. Raise your virtual hand if you've seen the movie starring Don Knotts from 1966, The Ghost and Mr. Chicken. Anyone remember seeing that movie? Oh, we got someone who's old like me. Way to go, Chris. So it's a fun movie. It was one of my favorite movies as a young boy. So in this particular clip that I'm going to share with you, the character Luther Heggs has to do a short talk from the podium, and everything that could go wrong in this talk goes wrong. It's a great illustration of all our fears being recognized, being de theatrically performed by Don Knotts in this 2.5 minute clip. So here we go, and then I'll kind of critique it at the end of it.
Thank you, Mayor, and fellow Rachelinians. That electrician must be a Democrat. Thank you, Mayor and fellow Rachelanians. I'm proud to be here today.
Attaboy,
Luther! when I was asked to be guest speaker at this luncheon, I asked myself this: who are you, Luther Heggs, to be a guest speaker at this luncheon? I thought about my answer about being guest speaker for a long time. What is a guest speaker? Let me clarify this. I have been called brave. What is brave? Let me clarify this. Of course, we all know that it is short for bravery. That goes without even being said. But it is also a symbol of another thing. It is a symbol of doing one's duty no matter what is scaring him personally.
Attaboy, Luther!
Take your World War II. There were many heroes in World War II. What were your heroes? Who were your heroes? Let me clarify this. Thank you for having me.
That's such a great clip. I just had the other day, I was thinking about this presentation and the thought occurred, Don Knotts, Mr. Chicken. And so I found this clip and edited it out. Now, a lot of things go on, as he comes to the podium, he's really nervous. The paper is shaking. Of course, your audience can see you. So, he's definitely nervous at the front there. Then there's technical issues with the mic. Then he makes a joke and it bombs. And then his notes fly away. Oh my God. And then the heckler who kept interrupting him, attaboy, Luther. These are all the things that can possibly go wrong during one of your shares. I remember I was doing a share, and in the middle of the presentation, this woman stands up who was obviously antagonized by what I was sharing, says, We've had just about enough of you. You can sit down now. And they had to whisk her away, you know? And these are things that can pop up to throw you off your game. Now, the good news that I like about this clip at the end, of course, the audience, no matter, it was a bad presentation, but they still clapped and they still wished him well. And you'll never have a more forgiving audience than a 12-step group of people. They will applaud. No matter how bad your talk is, they're going to applaud. Okay. So, 10 strategies for overcoming the fear of public speaking. And at any one of these points or any one of these slides, if you do have a question, feel free to raise your virtual hand and we'll bring you in to share. Okay, number one, structure your presentation. Avoid stream of consciousness. 90% of all glossophobia, that is the fear of public speaking, is triggered and caused by poor preparation and lack of awareness about the methods to manage it. So one of the things I'm very, very big on is there is a structure to how we share in a 12-step narrative, and we'll get into that. You know, so many times I've seen speakers go to the podium, they have no idea what they're going to share. You know, they go, I have no idea what I'm going to share. I'm going to let God, you know, direct my sharing. In fact, let me just do a prayer. And they'll actually do a prayer right there in their opening presentation, asking God to direct their thoughts and so forth. I get what they're doing, but to me, it's kind of an awkward way to open up your presentation. And then what happens is they start talking about whatever stream of consciousness is on their mind at that given moment. And this can be an impediment for delivering an effective message. Because one of the problems with the stream of consciousness is that sometimes you might deliver a great talk, but because you just went to the podium and spit out what was ever there, it's very difficult to duplicate that same presentation. The other thing I've seen people do is if they bombed badly with it, it was a terrible presentation, they have no idea to look back and reflect on what they could have done better or differently. So this is the problem I find with stream of consciousness presentations. You can be well rehearsed and know your talk and still appear spontaneous. And, you know, it's all just, you know, organically coming out. But there is a structure behind it. And writing down your presentation, write down your presentation in your own words. I recommend you avoid jargon and vulgar language. Like I say, when I'm speaking to an AA audience, I do not use vulgar language. When I'm speaking to CA, I can be a little grittier, a little more informal. That audience will accept it. But the other thing is jargon. Here in Toronto, we have a group of big book thumpers called the Muckers, and they muck up their book. And the passage where it talks about different types of drinkers, you know, the moderate drinker can take it or leave it. The heavy drinker, given sufficient reason, can stop or moderate. And then what about the real alcoholic? Well, the Muckers would always refer to these three types of drinkers as type ones, type twos, and type threes. And often I'd hear them share and they'd be talking about the type two drinkers. I'm not a type two drinker. I'm a type three drinker. And the audience is looking bewildered. What are you talking about? So if you're going to use jargon, define your terms when you speak. So you let the audience in on what it is you're talking about. But generally, I try to avoid jargon and vulgar language. And knowing your audience is important. When I've been asked to speak for an NA audience, I got to be very mindful of my narrative. They're on a different page. They don't use the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I must be mindful not to throw in things that might vex the audience. And know your messages, you know what it is that you're presenting, and avoid memorizing your share. You don't want to memorize it, because if you get thrown off your game or you have a mental blank spot, it can really be disastrous in your presentation. Of course, you want to rehearse your presentation, practice, you know, practice, practice, practice. Often, you know, you get a chance in these meetings where they have open discussion or you're invited to speak on a topic. I find these meetings really great in terms of working my material. I remember I was working on a humorous analogy of drinking bourbon. And I thought of this idea whereby I talked about they should market bourbon like cigarettes. You know, you pick up a pack of cigarettes, they always got a picture of really awful diseased lungs and all that sort of stuff. Well, they should have something similar with the bourbon bottle. They should have a picture of a woman with a black eye on it. And nobody in the audience laughed. And I quickly realized from that, trying that material out in a room, that was too close to home for a lot of people. A lot of people who have been abused by the alcoholic, and a lot of alcoholics that were doing the abusers. So I don't share that kind of humor from the podium. It just doesn't work. So you get an opportunity to rehearse different aspects of your share in the rooms and get an idea of what works and what really hits with your audience and what really doesn't. Number four, before speaking, take time for prayer and meditation. Whenever I'm asked to speak, you know, I like to get centered. You know, if it's an in-person meeting, I'll go to the washroom, I'll get centered, I'll wash my face, you know, I calm down and I'll sit at the back of the room and I'll get quiet and I'll reflect on the presentation and I get centered. And I'll even use, if there's a certain amount of intrepidation or butterflies in one's stomach, you know, doing the fear prayer from our big book, God, demonstrate through me what you can do, remove my fear, direct my attention to what you would have me be in at once I commence to outgrow this fear. And to visualize your presentation, visualize it, rehearse it in your mind, see yourself delivering an excellent presentation. It cues the mind for success. Number five, when speaking, focus on your audience. Most importantly, focus on carrying the message to the newcomer. You know, whenever I focused on me, when I used to go to the front of the room, and this was during when I did public speaking before I came into 12-step, I was always focused on how good I was going to look, how good was I going to be. And whenever I did that, I always went to the podium with a lot of fear and intrepidation because I'm focused on me. And that's not really what our program's all about. It's about being focused on the newcomer. So when I started focusing in on the newcomer, the person in my audience that needed to hear a message of experience, strength, and hope, my fears dissipated and I became much more connected to that approach and carrying that message. And I began to have a lot of fun at the front of the room. Because, you know, as I said, when I focus on me, you know, I get nervous and then I inevitably make mistakes. I forget my train of thought. I get flustered. So focusing on the newcomer, focus on the person who needs to hear the story. And as I said, remember our primary purpose, which is to carry the message the addict still suffers. Record your presentation. I remember I was working on my share where I talk about what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I outlined the 12 steps in my share. And I went to this meeting to share, and I brought a pocket recorder in those days. This was 2008. And I recorded myself. And it was a good share. And I had done all the things I just mentioned previously. I rehearsed it. I wrote it down. I was clear about what key messages I wanted to present. And it came out as a really good talk. And what's great about recording yourself when you do a share is you get to listen to yourself afterwards, you know, and you can make notes and you can revive your share accordingly to, you know, how you hear yourself present. Listening to yourself gives you that important feedback for understanding what's working, what's flowing, and what doesn't work well. Sometimes people say, Cameron, who's your favorite speaker? I go, I'm my favorite speaker. I love listening to myself. I listen to myself on a share. I go, man, this guy's really fabulous. You know, it reminds me of an old Jewish parable. If you're not your biggest fan, who's going to be? You got to be your biggest fan, right? So listen to yourself. It gives important feedback, but that's predicated that you record yourself. Oh, and, you know, when I recorded my share, at the time, there was a a speaker hub. It was located in Iceland, called xaspeakers.org. And I called them up after I recorded this share. I said, I just heard the most incredible speaker. You got to get this guy's MP3 on your hub. They said, well, send it to us, Cameron. So I fired off my MP3. They posted it. 25,000 downloads later, and being invited all across the world. I've been to Sweden, Denmark, Spain, across England, United States, Canada, all because of one initial share. Now, I know it's a little bit of promotion, but, you know, big doors will swing on small hinges. And, you know, you got to be your biggest fan anyhow. Remember, you'll never have a more accepting and forgiving audience. Your audience wants to do well. They want to hear your story. You know, we're conditioned to hearing the narratives of addicts talk about what they were like, what happened, and what they're like today. So they're a forgiving audience. As you saw in the end of the video clip, they're going to clap for you one way or another, regardless of how great or bad you are. When you're sharing your story, I recommend you share from the I perspective, avoiding using you language. You need to do this. You need to do that. You should be doing this. You should be doing that. It gets very preachy and self-righteous, and your audience can turn away from your message using that you perspective. I'll sometimes use a we perspective to be inclusive, but generally when I speak from the I perspective, it's my story. I experienced this. I did that. I achieved this. I got this result. And it's your story. You get to own it. No one can take that away from you. But the you perspective can create, you know, the optics of self-righteous preachiness, and people will try and take that away from you. And lastly, of course, when presenting, is to have fun. Have lots of fun up there. Okay, five ways to conduct yourself when speaking virtually or in person. So obviously, a lot of us are speaking virtually these days. You know, one of the greatest things that came out of COVID was the Zoom platform and the accessibility of the fellowship around the world, all fellowships. You know, I'm an alcoholic addict, and I work mostly in Cocaine Anonymous, but my message has carried over. I've spoken at Al-Anon meetings, CODA meetings, NA meetings, AA meetings, SLAA meetings, GA meetings. I've spoken to a lot of different 12-step fellowships out there as a result of the virtual meeting platform and the allowing, you know, meetings from around the world to be to have access to my message and shares. Now, before I come on to a virtual meeting, even this one that I did, I'm doing today, before presenting, I take a look at myself in the mirror or on camera. My usual retort is, wow, Cameron, how'd you get to be so fucking cool? But you want to take a look at yourself. Do you look well? Actually, you know, I always wear a tux now when I speak. And that came out of when I do the 12 steps, 4 hours workshop. The last workshop of the year was usually around New Year's. And we always made it a kind of a formal presentation. And all the women would dress up in evening attire and the men in tuxedos. And I got to thinking, I look really good in a tux. And so whenever I speak now, I always put on a tux. And I want my up close and personal face to be on and show that I care about my audience and I care enough to be mindful of how I'm presenting to the audience. When sharing virtually, you want to sit comfortably in your chair, unless you've got a standing workplace, a standing, you know, desk. Sit comfortably in your chair. I don't recommend you stand. You make eye contact with your camera. And you want your camera to be at the right level. You don't want it looking up your nose or, you know, looking down on your bald spot. I got a bald spot, but I'm tall enough you can't see it. You want to use a laptop or a desktop. I know some people only have a phone, but the phone's a little clunkier. A laptop, desktop, or even a tablet gives you a better, you know, screen space to work with. And you watch the facial expressions on your audience grid. Are they engaged? Are they smiling? Like, I'm watching Sharon all the time here because, you know, she's laughing, she's animated, and I think, oh, I'm really hitting the mark. So, you know, it's a good rapport, right? And I've never met Sharon before. This is our first time meeting, but she really likes what I have to say, so I'm really into it. So you want to you make eye contact with your audience and see if they're engaged. Are they smiling? Are they nodding their heads? And that tells you you're hitting the mark. And also, you want to smile, you want to speak clearly, you can modulate your tempo. Now, when you're doing virtual, because we're speaking through a mic, you know, we can play with our tempo and our modulation a bit. But we don't have to, you know, yell and scream like we might in an in-person meeting without a mic. But you want to vary your tempo. You don't want to be talking in a monotone for your whole presentation. You want to be dynamic, mix it up a bit. I'll let you in a little secret about virtual meetings. You can work with cheat notes, especially those of you that might have memory issues or you know, challenges about remembering things. The great thing about a virtual meeting is you can have your notes right there in front of you and they'll never even know. So it's the greatest platform for cheat notes to let you take away that initial fear. What if I forget where I'm at? Because you know exactly where you're at because you have your notes in front of you. That's a little facilitator tip about virtual meetings. Now, in-person meetings, live meetings, they're a little different. I'm a big fan of, and I learned this from doing shares in AA, to be well-groomed to dress appropriately. You know, I don't go and do a share in sweatpants and sneakers or, you know, a dirty shirt or whatever. You know, I dress for the occasion. You know, I want my host to feel like at the end of the presentation, they chose a good speaker, and the audience is appreciative of the host that they chose a good speaker. I don't want to embarrass my host. And I've done that in the past early on where I've said things or, that I shouldn't have said or done things that embarrassed my host. And I don't want to do that. When I'm speaking, I stand in one place, I plant my feet firmly at the podium. I've only seen one speaker over the years, and this is a secular speaker, and that was Tom Peters. He would wander back and forth on the stage and dynamically walk into the crowd and engage. Some people can do that, but for the most part, that takes a certain style of speaking and facilitation to do that. So most of us, you get to the podium, you stand at your podium, plant your feet firmly, and then as you start to present, make eye contact with someone in your audience and speak to that person for a few minutes. And then move on to another person, then move another. Pick a person from one side of the room, then pick a person from the other side of the room, pick a person into the back, pick a person in the front. And you move around and you connect with members of your audience. The audience loves it, and it's a great way of getting informed feedback that you're hitting the mark. People are engaged. If you have no mic, and sometimes you'll go to the front of the room and there'll be a large room, but there's no mic. There's no technology to amplify your voice. So you want to, if you have that situation, you want to project your voice as if you're speaking to the person in the very back row. So say it loud, say it proud. And as always, take note of your audience engagement. Are they engaged? Are they smiling? Are they laughing? Are they nodding heads? You know, I have humor intermixed with my presentation, and I know where people should laugh and where they don't. It varies depending on the audience. And remember, you can deliver the same talk word for word to one audience and present it again to another audience and get a totally different reaction. Those of you that are in acting or stage work can identify with that. You know, you can do a show one night that's fabulous, and the next day it kind of doesn't hit the audience the way it does. That's just the nature of speaking to audiences. You know, just take note of how your audience is responding. And again, like on a virtual meeting, you want to smile, you want to speak clearly, modulate for tempo. And so you can emphasize and be dynamic throughout your presentation. The benefits of speaking. There are three major benefits for speaking. Number one, the reason why we're asked to share our stories, remembering We all have a story to tell. We all have an important story. And somewhere in the room, there is an ear that needs to hear your story. Right? And our primary purpose, Tradition 5, is to carry the message of our hope, faith, and courage, or our experience, strength, and hope to the alcoholic or addict that still suffers. Reminding ourselves, our job here is to be of maximum service to God and our fellow human beings. And meetings should always be about the solution. I think, as my friend Chris R. from Texas say, they should be a pep rally for the spiritual way of life. Exciting. There is a solution, right? Now, we don't need to dwell on the problem. We're all experts in the problem. But to dwell, there is a solution. There's a way out of our predicament. And to communicate that to our audience, that there is a solution, imparting our experience, strength, and hope, our hope, faith, and courage, that there is a way out of this seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Another benefit of speaking. It reinforces our identity as members of a 12-step program. When I went back to university, I went back to university in my 50s, which was an amazing experience. And by the way, I've noticed three really good predictors of recovery. One is we work with others, 75% efficacy rate in sponsoring newcomers. Two, we go back to school and prove ourselves for, you know, our communities, our jobs, you know, et cetera. And the third thing I see people do that tell me they work a good program is they fix their teeth. Who's got money for teeth, right? Now, when I was at university, one of my professors had done a longitudinal study of recovery narratives, of recovery genres in the Food Addicts Fellowship. And I found that it was a really fascinating lecture she gave. And what she found was there are two genres, and this is fairly consistent with all of the 12-step fellowships. There's the recovering addict narrative versus the recovered addict. Now, what she found in recovery stories is she found them to be consequential, to have a direct effect on the person's experience of recovery. And she found that it seems that in the telling and the retelling of this empowered, recovered narrative, and it mentions in our big book 16 different times, we have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. The recovered narrative had clear beginnings, a turning point, and the favorable results, which were critical for a stable and consistent recovery narrative and way of being. You know, the recovered narratives, the old life was done and over with. We were reborn into a new way of life. There was a delineated boundary between the old life and the new life and all the promises that were fulfilled about living this program. And she also found that this narration not only articulated but facilitated the members' consistent affiliation with the appropriation of the 12-step master narrative, which is our instructions from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that's a rather thick description, but I'll come back to, you know, when we introduce ourselves, how do we introduce ourselves in the room? Recovering versus the recovered narrative. Alternatively, she found that in telling and retelling of an ambiguous, always recovering narrative in which the addict questions receive spiritual principles, they ponder hypothetical life paths that they don't actually pursue. They envision both abstinence as both good and bad, like the old life wasn't necessarily a bad life, the new life isn't necessarily a good life. And by keeping a cocky foot in the old life and a lazy foot in the recovered life, they piss all over their recovery. And what she found was they perpetuated a cyclical life course in which relapse would recur and recur and permanent recovery eluded them. So how we identify as members when we share our stories can have a significant impact on how well we manage our program and the quality of our program and the quality of our abstinence and permanent, consistent abstinence. I wrote a paper on 12 steps at university, and I was writing about these narratives, and I found another a number of different articles referring to these themes, that central to a 12-step recovery culture is the personal story of the recovered addict. Now, it says in our big book, our stories disclose in a general way what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now. Not what it was like, what we used to be like. So often I hear what it was like, but what we used to be like, what happened, that turning point, that significant shift, and what we're like today, which is the bragging rights to all the promises we've experienced. The member's personal story reinforces the figured world of 12-step recovery. Our narratives maintain the boundaries that structure and empower the 12-step recovery culture, because it's basically monkey see, monkey do. I think up until the 80s, we saw and heard so many war stories because that's all people were doing. So the next person thinks it's their turn to share. That's what they share, their war story. And thank God for Joe and Charlie coming along in the late 80s, reviving the big book message and speaking with a different narrative. By sharing our personal stories of what they used to be like, members will identify, hey, I'm like you, you're like me. Their war stories, and there is an element of our war story that we need to share, conveys important criteria for potential members, the audience sitting there. Am I in the right spot? Is this where I should be? And identify and label themselves as addicts. And lastly, on this point, and I know this is a bit pedantic, you know, these are very thick descriptions, but they're really, really important to understanding why our stories are important and how we share our stories. Furthermore, personal testimonies are significant to newcomers because the storylines of recovered addicts objectify the central cultural elements of a 12-step world, such as the importance of attending meetings, getting a sponsor, helping other suffering addicts, doing service work for a 12-step group. And by listening to the narratives of recovered members, newcomers learn the culture of our 12-step recovery rooms. The newcomer learns the model of a 12-step testimonial by listening to other members, and through telling their own story, the newcomer comes to understand their own life as a member of a 12-step program. And so the 12-step rhetorical language provides an attractive element that connects the newcomer to the 12-step culture and assures them that their drinking, their using, their acting out problem can be solved, and this can result in behavioral transformation of newcomers. I when I came across this material, I was just absolutely, wow, this is a really good third party credibility, you know, criteria for why we share the way we do in our rooms if we're making that impact.
Hey, Cameron, we had a hand up.
Oh, from, yeah. Go ahead.
Jennifer S.
Come
Jennifer
on in.
S.
Yeah, I just had a quick question, Cameron. Have you ever seen it where they've used the recovered narrative and the recovering narrative to where, like, they talk about their time in the recovering stage and then moving on to when they, you know, when they were recovered? Have you ever had that, or would you recommend that they stay in the recovered? Because I could see myself sharing about sort of like recovering and then you know, as I became recovered, right? I don't know if you've seen that. If that makes sense.
No, but I could see how one could apply that in early recovery where they're in the rooms and they're learning their program and they're working on recovering from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body and then transitioning to the point where they have recovered from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I think if it's coached in that kind of a structure, it works. But I do find that, you know, the one thing I have about the recovering addict, or identify, hi, my name's Cameron, I'm a recovering addict, and my relapse is simply an arm's length away from the next drink or drug, I find that not a very empowered, or, you know, an empowered way to be. And like I said, just based on what I was just talking about, it conveys a certain message to the audience that I don't think is necessarily a good one or a powerful one. But if you were to coach it in those terms in early recovery, because when I first came in, I was definitely recovering. Like, I was insane. I was in sobriety. I was going nuts in the room because no one gave me a solution. And I was just for today, don't let me drink, God. God, don't let me drink. Don't let me use. And it was brutal. It was white knuckling. And in a sense, yeah, I'm trying to recover, but I was definitely, you know, not embracing what our program's all about. So I guess it really depends on how you want to coach it and narrate around that. But if you did it in that manner, I don't see a problem with that. Now, the third benefit is Bill W. realized in order to save himself, he must carry the message to another alcoholic addict. Jennifer, I hope that answered your question.
Yes, thank you.
It's important for the newcomers to realize that your attempt to pass this message of experience, strength, and hope on to them plays a vital part in your recovery. Actually, they may be helping you more than you're helping them. I have carried the message through workshops and shared, well, the workshop. Some of you know I do the 12 steps, 4 hours workshop. We've taken over 14,600 people through that process. I've personally worked in a 7-day one-on-one approach using the instructions from the Big Book, which I conveyed to the newcomer over a 14-hour process over 7 to 10 days, 468 people through that process. And every time I go through it, I learn, and I've been doing it for 21 years now, I learn something new about myself. I learn something new about the program. I learn something new about newcomers every time I go through it. The program just keeps delivering day in and day out in that respect. And that's a huge benefit of the program. And it makes me a better sponsor in the long run. And of course, I get to keep my sobriety by giving it away and paying it forward. Three key elements for a compelling story. One is structure. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. There's substance to our message. The message, which can interest and hold these alcoholic or addicted people, must have depth and weight. And then the outcome. We believe that's only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems to the newcomers that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. So again, you know, the structures, what we used to be like, what happened, what we're like now, clear delineated boundaries between the old life and the new life, between the unrecovered life, the untreated life, and what it's like to be a recovered alcoholic or addict. Depth and weight to our stories. Now, I remember getting a hit of my, of the substance of my message was, I could not control it. I could not stay stopped when I wanted to stop. And I could not, once I started, I couldn't tell you how long it was going to last. It might go on a day, a week, a month, a year, maybe longer. I have no idea. I have no control to staying stopped. And once I do pick up, I can't stop. And I have no idea how much I'm going to consume and weigh. And so that the hair that's being split in our substance is the lack of control. All addicts, regardless of whether they're drug addicts, alcoholics, sex addicts, food addicts, cutters, hoarders, gamblers, codependents, you name the addiction pattern, the one thing we all have in common is lack of control. So if you're splitting that hair in what you used to be like, you're hitting the mark really well. You know, identifying with the person in the room, because they'll all relate to not having the control. Okay, so remember, we're here to carry the message, not the wreckage. We want to avoid drunkalogs or junkie pride stories. As I said, I already know how to drink. I already know how to use. I'm not really interested in getting more intel on that, what I was like. You know, what I'm like as an untreated addict. I'm looking for a solution. I've come into the rooms because I need a way out of this hole I find myself in. Another thing I see in the rooms are junkie pride stories where people are bragging about what they used to be like. There's nothing, there's no bravado in what I used to be like. I'm still atoning for the transgressions of my past untreated alcoholic addict life. There's no pride in it, but I see people in the podium making light or making it humorous and telling, you know, these awful stories with a sense of bravado and a sense of pride. And that's not really the message we want to carry. And often, sometimes meetings, especially what I call the open, disgusting meetings, where there's no solution. They're just Oprah Winefest, group therapy without a therapist. And it's just problem, problem, problem. And literally, they create psychological casualties by the end of the shares. It's just awful. I don't know how anyone survives meetings like that. Three ways to win the entire confidence of newcomers. Number one, we're ex-problem drinkers or addicts. That's a very compelling story. You know, I always introduce myself. Hi, my name's Cameron. I'm an alcoholic addict who doesn't drink or use, because I'm trying to convey to the newcomer, yes, I'm like you, but there's something different about me because I don't do it anymore. I'm an ex-problem addict. That's very compelling to someone who wants to stop but can't stop. So how you introduce and identify is as the ex-problem addict is key to that winning the newcomer's confidence. Hey, I'm like him. He's like me. I want what he's got. We have a solution. We found a solution, right? We have a 12-step program. I got a way out of the hole, and I'm willing to share it with you. Now, what earns me the right to share it with you? I'm properly armed with the facts about myself. I know what it's like to live in that hole. I know what defines me as an alcoholic addict. And I'm armed with those facts that I can share with the newcomer. And generally, in a few short hours, I can win the entire confidence of my prospect. And it's only then that we can start this journey. Until I have their understanding, little or nothing can be accomplished. So these are the three elements of a story that in our story, we want to hit these points if we're going to win the confidence of our audience, win the confidence of the newcomer that's looking for a way out of this problem. Now, generally, there are three types of shares that you can be asked to do. Introductions, how you introduce yourself, short, less than 1 minute. Sometimes I see this a lot in AA and sometimes in CA, but it varies from area to area and where you are in the world. Some meetings where the chair is speaking, they have to qualify what earns them the right to chair that meeting. And this is our 3 minute or less talk. It's our elevator speech. And then there's the main speaker share, where we share our hope, faith, and courage, which is our motto in CA, or experience, strength, and hope, which is generally the motto in a lot of other fellowships. And that could range from anywhere to 20 or 60 minutes, or maybe even less. Now, when you develop your share, be mindful of the content and how long it takes to deliver it. And be prepared to have a 15 minute, 30 minute, 45 minute, or a 60 minute version of your talk. Be flexible. Sometimes a meeting's preamble or member sharing can cut the speaker's time short. This is why it's important for you to know your presentation and to know your key messages. I remember I went to one meeting, it was an AA meeting, and it was a medallion, and I was supposed to speak for 25 minutes. Well, by the time it came my turn to speak, there were 7 minutes left in the meeting, and I had to deliver my share in less than 7 minutes because it's a big faux pas to go over time, right? 7 minutes. Now, I know my share intimately, so I pick out three key points that I need to convey to that audience and deliver in 7 minutes, and I did it, and it hit the ball out of the park, but only because I know I'm intimately aware of all my key messages in my talk and can be ruthless at cutting things out if I need to be to come within the allotted time to share. You don't want to be all prepared to do a 30-minute share and then it's your time to speak and you got 10 minutes. That could really throw you off your game. So know your talk and know what you can share and what time frame it needs to be delivered in. Sometimes when I'm asked to share, I will ask the host for a minimum of 30 minutes. I don't do it that often anymore, but there was a point a few years into COVID where Zoom meetings would have me share for 20 minutes. Well, it's difficult for me to share a hope, faith, and courage share of what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today in 20 minutes. I always make the joke, Jesus had 2 hours to deliver the Sermon on the Mount. Surely I can have, 30 minutes. Well, no, you can't, Cameron, and don't call me Shirley. Such a bad joke. sometimes I'll say you need to find a different speaker. But as of late, I have a variety of different topics I can speak about. I can speak about a certain step in 20 minutes or deliver a certain theme in 20 minutes. And so I will deliver in that time frame. But I've worked out, what kind of messages I want to share in that small amount of time. Introducing ourselves. Now, you can have a lot of fun introducing yourself at a meeting, bearing in mind that we're always trying to win the newcomer's confidence. We're trying to identify them. Hey, I'm like you. You're like me. I want what you have. So the most common thing I hear in the room is, hi, my name is Cameron. I'm an addict. My name is Cameron. I'm an alcoholic. And I get that. That's the standard opening you hear from 95% of the people introducing themselves at a meeting. But it's really only half the equation. Now, it's important for the newcomer. Oh, I'm in the right spot. Everyone's identifying as an addict or an alcoholic. Yeah, I'm in the right spot. But it's only half the story. So when I introduce myself, I like to say I'm an addict, alcoholic addict who doesn't drink or use. I'm deliberately conveying the problem. I'm an alcoholic addict, but I'm also revealing that I have found a solution. I'm an alcoholic addict who doesn't drink or use. And that's been my favorite way to introduce myself as of late. My name is Cameron. I'm a recovering addict. This is not my way of introducing myself. As Jennifer was mentioning, I might build a theme around untreated, recovering, and then recovered as a trajectory for sobriety. But generally, as an introduction, I do not use the term recovering addict. I think it always conveys in a subtle way that I'm still sick. I'm still an addict. I'll still be an addict. I'll always act out like an addict. Relapse is just an arm length away. And that's not the message I'm really here to impart. My name is Cameron. I'm a recovered addict. Now, I will occasionally announce that I'm a recovered addict if I have the opportunity to define what I mean by recovered. I think the worst scenario for this is, I'll work with somebody who's been using, they've had 3 or 4 days sobriety and detox. Now they want to rigorously work the steps. I take them through in a 7-day period. Now they got 10 days under their belt and they walk into a room and say, hi, my name is, and I'm a recovered addict. I think that is just a little too much ego and cockiness. And cockiness has a way of boomeranging in this program. I don't recommend that kind of cocky approach with 10 days of sobriety. They may have recovered, but time will tell, right? Time will tell if they've truly recovered. My name is Cameron. I'm a member of Cocaine Anonymous. My name is Cameron. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll sometimes do that. I'm a member. And then sometimes I'll elaborate on what it means to be a member. I'm an alcoholic addict, doesn't drink or use. My name is Cameron. I'm an addict who doesn't use or drink. My name is Cameron. I'm an addict who knows how to stop. That's another way you can have some fun with it. Whenever I'm in one of those rooms, especially the AA rooms where there's a lot of old timers, a lot of blue hairs, a lot of stodgy guys. I went to one meeting. They were called the Fifth Tradition Group. This group hadn't seen a newcomer in 20 years. All they did was work at like a Rotary Club and celebrate one another's sobriety birthday. So I come in and I introduce myself. My name's Cameron. I'm an intelligent agent, spearhead of God's ever advancing creation. It's great to be here. Oh man, they just kind of explode. Oh, who does he think he is? That's a lot of ego, if you ask me. That's right out of our big book, page 49. Are we not intelligent agents, spearheads of God's ever advancing creation? So you can have a lot of fun introducing yourself, mixing it up, and standing out of the room. You use a different approach when you introduce yourself. People will take, whoa, what did that person just say? And they'll pay attention because we're trying to reach them. So often when we go around them, introduce ourselves, or we read our preambles, nobody's, in my opinion, nobody's listening. You could read, how it works. I've heard it thousands and thousands of times. And you ask a person, what's the first line of how it works? and they'll look at you blank out. It's rarely do we see a person fail who thoroughly follows our path, right? But how many people can actually articulate? Because they just blank out. It's just the yap, yap, yap of the meeting, right? So you want to stand out. You want to come up with a narrative that, whoa, that's different, you know, and grab the attention of the newcomer. Qualifying as an addict. What qualifies you to share a message? What are the facts about yourself? What can you say in 3 minutes or less that will persuade those in the meeting to say, yes, I'm like you and you're like me, but you don't do it anymore? So the key elements that you want to include in a 3 minute elevator talk. Yeah, go ahead, Darren. Come on in.
Hi, Cameron. I just want to say, if you like, you're on about the you know, introducing yourself and all that. Obviously, I'm in GAM, but I've heard people say, you know, when they come on, you know, my name is so and so. I'm a grateful, and blah blah blah. You know, yeah. You know, have you ever heard that?
Yeah, I've heard. Oh, that's a good one to bring up. Yeah, I'm a grateful addict. It's great to be here. Now in GA, there's Gamblers Anonymous, right? Yeah, and Gamblers Anonymous, you know, I would say, hi, I'm a gambler who hasn't placed a bet in X number of days, or I'm a more specifically, I'm a gambler who doesn't bet. You know, because as we know, the dope of the gambler is the risk of the bet. That's their dope, right? And they don't do that anymore. And that's very compelling to a gambler who can't stop betting, who meets people who can. I remember I went to a GA meeting. I brought a bingo addict. She was a $500 a night bingo addict, hopeless. I remember her daughter called her up at the bingo hall saying, Mom, the house has been ransacked. It's been, everything's overturned because, you know, loan sharks were looking for their money. And the mother said, oh dear, I'm in the middle of a game. I'll be home in a couple hours. Just sit tight and I'll be home. Right. And I took her to a GA meeting and she introduced herself to the chair, and the chair says, hi, I'm a gambling addict who haven't placed a bet next number of days or weeks or whatever it was. And then I introduced myself. Hi, my name's Cameron. I'm an alcoholic addict, doesn't drink or use. He goes, oh, well, we're different from you. I said, really? I said, let me understand this. Now, when you're acting out as a gambler and you go to the casino and you start placing bets and you lose all control, and eventually what happens is either you bust or you get thrown out of the casino. Is that you? Yeah, yeah, that's my MO. And you're usually filled with a sense of horror and remorse, and you don't want to do that anymore, right? Yep, that's me. And then you make a firm resolution never to place another bet again, don't you? He goes, yeah, that's exactly me. And then you succumb to desire again, you place another bet, and you repeat the behavior over and over and over again, don't you? Yeah, that's me. Yeah, I can understand how we're different. Right? There is a universality to all of our addiction patterns. But yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Darren. That's another way people can say it. I'm grateful for being here. I'm grateful to AACA, 12-Step Fellowship in general, because it gives me a forum to, you know, manage and navigate my recovery. And I'm grateful for that. So what can I say in 3 minutes or less? Hi, my name's Cameron. I'm an alcoholic addict, doesn't drink or use. You think about that, that's kind of a paradox, because everything in my step one experience will tell me I will drink and I will use again. And to do so is to die. And the horror of that is because I got this liar that lives in my head constantly convincing me that this time when I drink or use, somehow I'm going to control and enjoy it. And the problem is the liar would always win the argument. And when I drink, I have no idea how long I'm going to drink and use for. Maybe a night, a day, a week, a month, a year longer. I have no idea. And then I'll come out of that and I'll be full of horror and remorse and I'll make a resolution not to do it again, only to succumb to the desire again and go back out and repeat that wheel of misfortune, pursuing the love of drinking and using to the gates of insanity or death. And nothing secular, nothing human, nothing psychological is going to stop me from doing that. And to do that is I'm going to die. Yet as a member of Cocaine Anonymous, it's been 21 years since I've had any desire to drink or use. I met someone in the rooms armed with the facts about themselves. They were ex-problem addicts and they had a solution. And with a generosity of spirit, they showed me a way out of that hole. and using the program, I rebuilt a destroyed marriage. My wife and I are celebrating 35 years of marriage this year. I have the love and trust of my children, 39 and 42. I'm a grandparent now. What a gift. My liver went back to normal after 6 years in the program. Went back to university, graduated, top of my class in medical anthropology and religions. And I travel all over the world speaking in AA and CA about how to recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. It is a stellar life being a member of Cocaine Anonymous. There, 3 minutes or less. I've covered a gamut of points, right, in that share. So work on a three-minute talk. You know, you never know when you're going to have to deliver one like that. Main speaker share, opening, introduce yourself. So again, have some fun with introducing yourself. Share what you used to be like. This is where we want to tell an effective war story. Win the newcomer's confidence. This is kind of your point two. Your war story is your jaywalker story. Everyone should have a jaywalker story. By the way, it's always kind of ironic that AA is all about alcoholics. We're different than everybody else. Yet they wrote the narrative, the jaywalker story, replaced jaywalking with alcohol to make the analogy that the jaywalker is the alcoholic and an alcoholic's like a jaywalker. Well, you could use the same analogy to substitute jaywalking for drinking, for using, for gambling, for acting out in sex or food. They make a case for any and all addictions. I love the jaywalker story. What's your jaywalker story? Then you want to share what happened, how you hit bottom, how you reached that turning point, that moment of clarity, that jumping off place where you thought, I got to go a different way, and how you found and worked a 12-step solution. That's really why we're in the rooms. We want to hear what happened. You know, I always find it interesting when someone is celebrating a medallion, they always bring in another speaker. I always thought the person who's getting the medallion should be the speaker. They're celebrating 1 year, 2 years, whatever number of years sobriety. That should be, I want to hear how they did that, right? I always thought the medallion receiver should be the one that does the talk. And then, of course, you want to share what your life is like today. This is your bragging rights. What are you like today? You want to talk about the promises fulfilled, how your life has taken on a new meaning, how you found the fellowship that you crave. And then you want to close your talk with that signature sign-off. So, opening your share. Introduce yourself. Tell a humorous analogy or short story. Cite a big book quote. You want to hit them right. You hit them right off the hop with something different as you introduce yourself. So, you know, my name is Cameron. I'm an alcoholic addict, doesn't drink or use. Think about that. That's a paradox. That's a typical way I'll kick things off. And then if you've heard my shares, I have different ways of sharing. I have one where I talk about, I love going into the rooms. I always love to ask the question, are you working a program? And I hear a lot of different responses. Oh yeah, I work a program, go to a meeting every day, sometimes three meetings a day, meeting makers make it 90 and 90. No, that's not what I'm talking about. Are you working with someone? Oh yeah, I got a sponsor. Don't make a decision until I talk to my sponsor. My sponsor manages my entire life, tells me who to sleep with, how to manage my money. I don't make a decision until I talk to my sponsor. No. That's not what I'm talking about. Are you working with newcomers? And they look at me like I got three heads. Newcomers? I'm still a newcomer. I've only been in the program 2 years. This is a selfish program. I got to work on me first. And I never see them again. So that's another way you can, it's a humorous analogy or a short story. Sometimes you can tell a joke. If you really want to risk being out there, open with a joke. I have one where I talk about, it's a CA joke. So a hard user and a real addict go to the crack dealer. And the crack dealer says, oh my God, you won't believe this, but I got this magic eight ball of crack cocaine. It's the blingest, purest crack you'll ever smoke. You get a ringer every time. And here's the magic. It never goes down in size. And the hard user says, well, I'll take one of those. But what does the real addict say? You better give me three. Right? So if you want to have some fun, open with a joke. But be prepared. Sometimes the joke may not go over. And I've told some jokes that really have fallen flat on their face. I remember I was sharing about step five and confession, and I made the joke. Yeah, there's a passage in step five that says those of us belonging to a religious denomination will want to go to the properly appointed authority. And of course, they're speaking about Catholics here and going to a priest. Well, I went to a priest with my moral inventory, but he didn't want to hear a moral inventory. He wanted an oral inventory. And all I got was a blowjob. And the audience was dead quiet. There wasn't a peep. And I'm tapping the mic. I go, hello? Hello? Is this thing on? Ooh, bomo. And then I got some giggles and I moved on. But sometimes your joke may fall flat. But I have a lot of fun with it. Or cite a big book quote. One of my favorite big book quotes is, practical experience shows that nothing ensures immunity against drinking or using or acting out as intensive work with other addicts. It works when all other activities fail. That's my favorite because my general theme is always working with others. Another favorite quote I heard Richard from the Richmond Group in England open with, page 95 of the big book, read this book. That was his opening quote. I love that. Read this book. So, you can and be prepared to have several different kinds of openings. I remember I was speaking in British Columbia. And I always tell this story in a lot of my shares about the addict in the hole and how, you know, the family and the friends and the employer come by and they try to help the addict out of the hole. But he trades the ladder in for, you know, a drink or a drug. And digs his hole a little deeper. And then there's the religious community that comes along, the medical community, the treatment center community, all trying to help the addict out of the hole, but none of them can encourage the addict out of the hole. And then, you know, what does the real addict do? They jump into the hole with them and say, I got a way out. Well, that was an important part of my opening. Well, before I'm about to be introduced, the MC shares that analogy with the audience. So now all of a sudden my classic opening isn't going to work the way it should. So I had to come up very quickly with another way to open. So you want when be prepared for anything when you go to the podium. So, you know, have a couple of different shares or different openings prepared and, you know, start sharing. My shares can sometimes be controversial and trigger a lot of people. So sometimes I open up with page 125 of your big book. Most alcoholics, are sensitive people. It takes a long time to overcome this serious handicap. Trigger warning here, folks. And then I'll make a joke. And if you are triggered and you're upset with what I had to share, you know, people come up and you go, oh, Cameron, that was awful. You shouldn't have done that. You shouldn't have said that. And I go, whoa. Hey, save it for your sponsor. It gets them right wound up. Oh, my God. Okay. What we used to be like. How should we tell our war story? There is a way to tell our war story. And what I love about the big book is it gives us specific instructions on how we share our story. Tell them, the newcomer, enough about your drinking, using, acting out, habits, symptoms, and experiences, and encourage them to speak of themselves. That's kind of your jaywalker talk. Tell them how baffled you were. How you finally learned that you were sick. Remember when you find at some point you're drinking, using, or acting out, you realize, hey, there's something different about me. The story I like to share is I'm at a, you know, back in the day when I worked the financial districts of Toronto, I'm in a three-piece pinstripe suit in those days. Women are always in, you know, their business attire. And every Friday night, there was always some kind of posh party going at some luxury condominium. And we'd all go, and I'd be in my suit, and the women would be in their business attire, and there was a lot of drinking, and in the 80s, there was a lot of cocaine, good cocaine. So I'm at this meeting, and everyone's drinking and doing lines of coke, and I'm sitting on the sofa, and this guy says to me, Cameron, would you like a few lines? I said, I'd love to do a few lines. So as he's cutting me out these lines, I take my suit jacket off, I roll up my sleeves and my arms are covered in track marks because I'm a intravenous needle user. And I put a needle and spoon on the table because I always went equipped, and the party stopped. It went dead quiet. And the hostess comes up to me and says, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm going to do my lines." She says, "You can't shoot up in the middle of our little soiree like you're some kind of street junkie." And I retorted, "What? You're judging my delivery system? Is this what we're talking about?" And I was politely escorted to the door with my lines, of course. And as I'm leaving, I'm thinking, I don't drink and I don't use like these people. There's something different about the way I approach my drinking and drugging. You know, it's an important part of your story when that you kind of turn the corner from being able to take it or leave it alone to something quite different. Give them the account of the struggles you made to stop. List all those secular, human, psychological approaches that failed to keep you in check. Do you know it's universal? All the different ways we've tried to stop, control it, manage it, regardless of the addiction pattern, they're very universal. So if you're identifying with the newcomer on failed strategies, you'll make a much better connection than, you know, the joke I sometimes use in AA is, just because my employer thinks I have a drinking problem because I wore a lampshade at the Christmas office party on my head doesn't make me an alcoholic. Doesn't make me a lamp either, right? So, you know, how we identify, you know, I'm an everyday bourbon drinker, but I've worked with drinkers who drink beer only, wine only. I've worked with binge warriors, weekend warriors. I've worked with blackout drunks. I've worked with blackout drunks that smoke crack cocaine, not because they're crackheads. They smoke crack cocaine so they're more lucid and can drink longer. So behavior patterns can vary a lot within, even in a certain addiction pattern. But you can universally identify with any addict if you stick to the failed strategies you made to stop. And then show the newcomer how the mind lies, that mental twist that always leads to the first drink or the first drug. And I use the liar analogy. A lot of addicts get the idea that they have a liar that lives in their head trying to convince them to pick up or act out. And so that's how I qualify. That's how I share what my life was like, just enough for the newcomers and the people in the room go, "Hey, I'm like you, you're like me," right? That's all I'm doing in what I used to be like. You know, another element that I say, I'm restless and I'm irritable. I'm discontented, bored, depressed. And the liar doesn't like to feel that way. So drinking and drugging is my solution. It's not my problem. It's my solution to what ails me. Addicts can relate to that. It's a key element to what I used to be like. And then what happened? Tell them what happened. Tell them exactly what happened to you and stress the spiritual feature freely. A 12-step program is a spiritual moral approach to the efficacy of our addiction pattern. Describe your last bottom, that jumping off place, that turning point. Talk about how you found your sponsor. You know, share your experience of attending meetings and how and when you started your step work. Share about the service work you've done. Talk about what's going on that allows you to find sobriety and maintain your sobriety. So I sobered up on October 31st, 2003. I'll never forget, I'm fishing for brown trout. And I caught two that morning, about 16, 17 inches, beautiful trout. I'm drinking cold Corona beers and I'm smoking $400 an ounce dope, the best dope I could buy. And it's a gorgeous day. And I am miserable inside and out. I hated myself and I hated everybody else. And as I'm sitting there, I thought, I don't want to live this way anymore. It was a moment of clarity. I don't want to live this way anymore. And I remember coming home and sharing to my wife that I'm going to go to AA and sober up. And I remember her sobbing. And I got such a visceral hit of how much damage I had done to my family at that point. Now, that was October 31st, 2003. My sobriety date is November 21st, 2003. Why? Because on November 20th, my friend invited me to the food show. And they were doing beers from around the world. But they would only give you a little sip of a beer in a communion cup. Those of you who've taken communion, you've seen communion cups. They're really tiny. And the communion cup had less than a half of a cup of beer in it. And I thought, this is not even a sip. That certainly can't affect my sobriety. But when you drink 400 of them, so that's why my sobriety date is November 21st, 2003, rather than October 31st. You want to stress the spiritual feature freely, and you want to put it in your own words. You don't want to get to talk about your own concept. You don't want to get into the theological terms or concepts, because that can distract. Just keep in your own words, be real matter of fact, but stress it, right? Because it is a spiritual, moral way that we find our way out of the hole we find ourselves in. What we are like now, talk about the promises fulfilled in your life. How is your health, your family, your work life has changed? Share about the fellowship you found. These are your bragging rights. This is where you get to reiterate, there is a solution. There is hope. There is faith. There is courage. I am reborn into a whole new, exciting way of living. You know, for me, I've got, it'll be 21 years of sobriety, and my birthday is coming up November 21st. One of the things I found is I was violent as an untreated alcoholic. I raged daily, and I'd have weeks, months of these murderous black depressions. I don't suffer that anymore. I'm relaxed. I'm calm. Every now and then I'll get agitated. Very rarely will I actually lose it and then end up having to do inventory around it. But once in a blue moon, I'm much more calm and serene, and I'm centered because I meditate and pray on a regular basis, daily basis. I've restored my marriage with the tenets of steps 8 and 9. My wife, man, she's my best friend, my confidant, my soulmate, my business partner. And we've been together 35 years. We're like marbled meat. I don't know where I end and she begins and vice versa. Like, it really is incredible. My children, who are estranged from me, I have a really tight relationship with my 39-year-old daughter, whom I share a lot of similar humor and reading and movies with her. My son's 42. He just made me a grandfather again with a baby girl, Vera Lynn, born on November 11th of last year. She's 9 months. And you can just see her trying to work out this thing we call words. Oh my God, I was not prepared for how that little girl stole my heart. You know, my liver went back to normal after 6 years. I went to university. You know, it's like, it is an amazing life living this program. And I'm very involved with all three legacies of 12 steps. I have my recovery and I teach to other people. I'm always working with newcomers pretty much every day for the last 21 years. I'm involved with the fellowship. I love the traditions and their principles, the unity of our fellowship. We're all on the same page. We're all trying to be of maximum service to God and our fellow human beings. And the service legacy of being involved in service at the group level or the district level, the area level, or the world level of our fellowship. And to practice all the principles I learned in 12 steps and in traditions and concepts, and they get a chance to actualize them at the group, district, area, or world level. And that is the icing on the cake. And the skills that I demonstrate and learn in this environment we call 12-step are transferable skills into our secular lives. So there's a lot of magic and a lot of bonus and benefits of living this program. I think everyone could benefit from a 12-step program. It's just most people won't do it because it's not life and death like it is for us. But this is what my life is like today. And I can't say enough about how wonderful this program is. Lastly is our signature sign-off. Again, you close your presentation with a short story, an analogy, or a book quote. Sometimes I share when I'll open my story with the person in the hole, and I will talk about all the different people that try to help the addict out of the hole but can't. And then I'll go into my talk, and then I'll come back to the whole story at the very end and say, what should we do as addicts? We jump into the hole with the newcomer. And they're baffled. And they look at us, confused. Now we're both in the hole. But we can look at our brothers and sisters with a wink in our eye and we can share with them, hey, it's okay. I've been here before. I got a way out with more experience, strength, and hope, a way out to walk hand in hand with the sunlight of the Spirit, a way out to be intelligent agents, to be spearheads of God's ever-advancing creation. And I'm for that. How about you? God bless you on the firing lines of recovery. That's generally the way I always close with, I'm for that. How about you? See you on the firing lines. We all have favorite quotes in the big book. Pick your favorite quote, you know, or a quote that is in line with the theme that you're presenting around your story. And again, it leaves your audience with, like, you know, it's a nice way to finish off the story. It's got a nice crisp close to it. And everyone in the room's thinking, wow, they're like me. I'm like them. They don't do it anymore. I want what they got. You know, whenever I speak, I'm never short of people wanting to work with me. And, you know, that keeps me very involved with the program. Just wrapping up, I want to thank everyone for joining us. I'm going to keep the parking lot open. So if you have any questions and would like some answers, we'll leave it open and you can, and we can delve into that. I do want to reiterate one more time. It's well over $100 to do these workshops with our Zoom costs, our website costs, and all the stuff that goes into making it work. It's voluntary, but if you feel there's value in this presentation, we do four of these a year, and you'd like to see it continue, please consider a seventh donation, whether it be 20, 10, or 5. You can use the QR code or go directly to our website. It takes you to our PayPal page. You can either pay through a PayPal account or you can use your credit card. You have those options to make a donation with, and we really appreciate it. My last sound clip of the night. Money, get away, get a good job with your pain, you're okay. And lastly, I look forward to hearing your share or talk at the next 12-step meeting or convention. Now, if you want, I will do anything within my power to help you put together the best talk you can put together. So if you want, you can reach out to me. I'll get Larissa and I'll post my phone number in the chat. Reach out to me. We can set up a Zoom meeting and you can present to me your talk as you have it and I'll record it. And we'll talk about things you can do to take it to the next level. And then you can go away, listen to your current share, look at where you want to change it, adapt it, move it up, and then connect with me again and re-present, and I'll record that too. And we can see about taking your share to another level. That's I offer that to all of you. It's was freely given to me. I freely wish to give it to you. There's no charge for any of that sort of stuff. And I'd love to be able to help you do that and learn from your dry runs and improve your share. And I'm for that. How about you? God bless. And thank you so much for letting me share with you today.